Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me today is pensions and investment editor Tanya Jeffries and assistant personal finance editor Helen Crane. And coming up, house prices continue to rocket, but are they about to come crashing back down to earth soon? We revisit the 18-year property cycle theory, also sticking with property and help to buy owners moving home are finding rising house prices have bumped up their debts, but are creating a nice little earner for the government. Plus 2-year mortgage deals for under 1%. But is it better to go long? Also today, we talk about the latest research telling us how much we need for a decent retirement and answer a taxing pension query from a reader. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, another month, another record house price figure. They're up 10.9% annually in May. That's according to Nationwide, the strongest growth in nearly 7 years. Now, May's figure is up from the 7.1% annual increase that we saw in April. So, you know, real monies, what does that actually mean? Well, it means the average place is going to set you back £23,930 more than had you bought 12 months earlier. Helen, not down to the stamp duty holiday this time. That is an enormous amount on average, because bearing in mind across the country, that will be different.
Yeah, it's a huge increase. We've seen these increases for the best part of the last year, really, since we came out of the first lockdown. People have obviously gone mad for moving house. I think typically in an average year, about 5% of homes change hands. And Nationwide has said that at the moment, a quarter of homeowners are either looking to move or interested in moving. So it's gone absolutely bananas. These are sort of levels of house price increases not seen since before the financial crisis. It's massive.
I know that, Tanya, we had the Mortgage Market Review and all those sorts of measures that were put in place to make sure that we didn't have a repeat of what we saw during the financial crisis, people buying homes that they couldn't afford. But trying to find an extra 24 grand down the back of your sofa, particularly if you're a first-time buyer, doesn't sound like an easy task. Is there a danger that some people may still be overstretching themselves despite all these sorts of measures in place to make sure that that doesn't happen?
I think they're absolutely bound to be, because every time this happens, there are always people who will overstretch themselves. It's just human nature. It's just a matter of whether there are safeguards in place to stop them. Helen will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there are much stronger safeguards in place from the lender's side now to make sure that people who can't afford a property don't get a loan. They put you through more hoops now. And maybe that will stop people who be very upset, I expect, being turned down. But it may well be better for them in the long run if the lender says no.
Lenders aren't necessarily being too irresponsible here. They have been quite sensible, actually, since the pandemic. At the very start, they took away a lot of their high loan-to-value mortgages. So they wouldn't loan for people with just sort of 5% deposits. They've only just sort of recently brought those back. And the affordability checks are very strict, much stricter than we saw in the past. There are people who are trying to buy homes and then they're finding the property is being downvalued by their mortgage lender and they won't lend to them, which, as Tanya said, that is gutting if it happens to you, but perhaps in the long term for the best. You know, you don't want to end up in negative equity. So I think broadly lenders are being sensible.
If this is all about the race for space, as it were, how long do we expect this to continue for? Until we all have a house with lots of garden space and a shoffice? I don't think, sadly, we can all have those things, can we?
Yeah, I mean, we are still seeing the prices of flats aren't growing anything like the prices of houses. You know, if you're looking for a 3-bed detached home, that's where you're really going to be paying these big premiums. That seems to be set to continue as we come out of lockdown restrictions. You know, people have decided it's actually quite nice to have a garden and enough room to kind of play within your house, and I don't think that's going anywhere. But in terms of the prices, I think they are going to have to come down at some point. There's a few theories. I mean, some people are saying there's going to be a big crash once the stamp duty holiday ends in October others are a bit more sort of temperate about it, saying it'll be a kind of flattening rather than a big dip. At the minute, we just don't really know. There are other factors going into it other than stamp duty, you know, the sort of lifestyle changes, people kind of moving away from cities and things like that because they don't have to go into the office as much. You know, those things will continue. But I think the stamp duty holiday has been a massive incentive. And I think you can't kind of get away from how big an impact that's had.
On reflection, Tanya, do you think it was a mistake, the stamp duty holiday?
Well, it was kind of an emergency measure, wasn't it, at the time? The trouble with these things, it's easy to bring them in and really hard to stop them, especially if you're going to have some kind of cliff edge, which it seems we're heading for. I mean, they've put it back several times now. I wouldn't even be surprised if they don't extend it again in the autumn. They'll keep losing their nerve. There'll be something else. I mean, let's hope we don't have another wave of the virus. But if there's a massive, massive unemployment in the autumn, there's another wave of coronavirus, are they really going to end the stamp duty holiday? I don't know if you could say if it was a mistake overall, because like a lot of things, you know, done with the best intentions in a very difficult situation. But we are definitely seeing how difficult it is to get out of.
I don't know about whether it was a mistake to bring it in or not, but I do wonder at the thought that they would extend it. I mean, I think the Chancellor very recently said that they're not going to get rid of it altogether, which I know a lot of people would like to see, but it brings in, well, normally it's about 12 billion. I think it brought in just under 9 billion to the Treasury in a time when, well, they could probably do with the extra change, let's be honest. So we do have a bit of a tapering off, Helen. We've got that. They're saying that this change in house prices isn't down to the stamp duty holiday this time. It's due to the race for space. But could it be down to something else? Could we just be part of the 18-year property cycle theory that Simon's spoken about all the time? And actually, this was planned. Anyway, what am I talking about? Well, this is money spoke to the guy who basically predicted the last two slumps. Now, if he's right, we aren't going to be in line for a crash for another 5 years, Helen. Just tell us a little bit more about that.
So this guy, his name's Fred Harrison. He's an author and a economic commentator. He claims to have successfully predicted the previous two property crashes in the 1990 and 2008. He claims that we could have avoided the 2008 financial crisis if Tony Blair's government had heeded his warning. So he's making some quite big claims, but he is broadly, he has been right. So if his theory is correct, it's this 18-year property cycle. And we're basically right at the start of the boom phase, which obviously fits in with what's happening now. And we'll be in for a crash in around 2026.
So does that mean he's sort of suggesting that this could go even higher?
I think it would be kind of at peak now, and then it would plateau and then dip in a few years' time, is the theory. So it's goes on upward trajectory, then kind of 6 or 7 years of modest growth, and then the dip is the theory.
I mean, no one's suggesting, Tanya, apparently he saw the financial crisis coming and he predicted all of this. This man obviously does his research. I'm not questioning any of that. I'm not suggesting it's twice lucky, because, you know, once you could say that, twice is quite good. But 18 years sounds very precise, doesn't it? And I don't know that he foresaw a global pandemic in the latest round.
Well, he says he's basing this on absolutely hundreds of years of research in lots of different countries, so therefore he has analyzed many, many years of data. It's difficult to say. 18 years is very precise, but if he can match it up to historical records of how economies as well as housing market, property markets boom and bust, then I think we can accept that. There certainly are economic cycles, aren't there? One of the interesting things that he says is about the causes of it all. He thinks that there's the shortage of land, the sort of the finite amount of land is a problem, and that's why there's the current boom. He doesn't think so much of low interest rates play a part, he says, but he really thinks it's the land shortage. I mean, the government could get to grips with that, in my opinion. You know, I've always thought that the house builders build in a way that maintains a certain amount of supply so that they keep their profits up. Therefore, you know, some measures to sort of ensure that more houses were built would be welcome. I also don't think that we've explored enough the possibilities of changing our town centres. They're changing anyway in front of our eyes. And I think a lot more could be done rather than having the endless row about planning rules in the suburbs and what should we do about the green belt and so on. I really think we need to explore the potential of having more housing in town centres and bring them to life a bit again by just having people living there.
Helen, what are your views about that? Town centres and lots of different ideas. I guess we're all working differently. If we're spending less time in the city centres, we may be reviving our rural towns. Things will look very different.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an idea that always comes up whenever there's a big retailer that goes under. So, for example, when BHS went under, a lot of people said, well, you know, we've got all this space in town centres now. Why don't we make it into flats? It's not a bad idea, but it does... living in a town centre kind of lends itself to working in a town centre. You know, it's going to be sort of younger people who want to live close to the office. And maybe if we're not going to the office as much, that idea has a bit less traction. You know, you've seen people in the last year moving out to the country to get that kind of lifestyle. And that doesn't necessarily fit with living in a town centre, I guess. But, you know, different locations, perhaps a market town, something like that could work really well. But if you're looking at somewhere like high streets in London, you know, we've already seen interest dip in the last year. So perhaps that idea is a bit kind of fallen by the wayside.
I just want to ask Helen, we can think about, you know, future town plannings and all those sorts of things, and will a crash happen in 2026? But if you're sitting there, you know, as a first-time buyer, let's say, and you're, you know, desperately trying to raise that extra bit of deposit because house prices have just gone up, you want to know, do I go for it now if I want a home, or do I hold fire a little bit, perhaps rent a little bit longer? What would you do?
Yeah, I mean, it's worth thinking about for first-time buyers. We are, by most accounts, at the peak of the market. So if you're buying now, there is a risk that price will go down and you won't get back what you paid for it, or you won't get as much of a gain as you kind of might have liked. You might struggle to sort of trade up to your next home. But I mean, you, in all these things, you have to think about your life and your lifestyle and what you want. You know, it's at the end of the day, you do buy a home to live in. You don't buy it as an investment for most people. If you can afford to buy now, and that would save you however many years of giving money to a landlord in rent, you know, is it such a bad idea? Perhaps not. You know, obviously you need to look at where you're buying and that you're buying a decent property that will hopefully appreciate in value. But, you know, for most people, they just want somewhere to live. And if you buy at the top of the market, you buy at the top of the market. If it's your home and, you know, you don't necessarily want to make heaps and heaps and heaps of money on it, you just want to get some equity, trade up, it's for most people, it's probably going to be okay.
I just think it's such a strange time, Tanya, as well, during the pandemic, and the way that, as I mentioned there, work may be changing. If you don't have to go into the office, you're not tied perhaps to the South or London area. Why would you be spending almost double buying a house down here? You know, maybe it might be a good idea to wait to see how the jobs market is going to change. Are we going to be working from home, and then let that inform your decision?
Yes, I actually think it will be a good thing if we all spread out over the country, and that the South and South, you know, the Southeast isn't quite so hot on the housing market. It will be good for the entire country if that's the case. I obviously hope that we're going to return to the kind of life that we had before the pandemic, but maybe with a few adjustments that we've discovered are quite good along the way. And one of those is more flexibility with home working. I think even the people that go back to the office full time, there will be some adjustments around the edges where employers will be more flexible with how they're able to work from home sometimes. Yeah. Whether that's enough to make you move much, much further away and lengthen your commute, I don't know. It may well be down in the end to your individual employer and making a judgment call as to as to what they're going to do in the future. The people who say to me, my employer hasn't even really talked about it, I'll be amazed if we go back to the office by the end of the year. Well, if your employer is taking that attitude at this stage, then you can maybe feel a bit more comfortable about moving further out. But the people who I know who are already back in the office some of the time and know that their employer is chomping at the bit to get them back in the office, well, yeah.
Exactly. I was just thinking then about the things that can stay, the things that can go. You know, working from home, one of them. I'm quite antisocial, so, you know, the distancing in restaurants is nice in the past. Sitting on your lap and eating with someone else, which was not pleasant. And sanitizing in gyms, big fan of that. That can stay. Lots of other things can't. But I want to talk, Helen, if that's all right, about one group particularly not benefiting from the rise in house prices is those that bought using Help to Buy and they're looking to sell. They're seeing their debt bumped up, but it's created a nice little earner for the government. So just, you know, firstly, how does Help to Buy work? What is it?
So the Help to Buy equity loan, it's been around for a few years now. Basically, first-time buyers, they take a equity loan from the government, which is 20% of the purchase price of their house. So that means they can get a bigger deposit and probably a better mortgage rate than they would have done otherwise, because they're going with a bigger deposit. That's fine, but they have to then repay the loan within 5 years, otherwise they have to start paying interest on it and the rates climb quite quickly. So the ideal is that you buy a home and then you remortgage or you sell after 5 years, use the equity you've gained to pay the government back, and then you're kind of free to do what you like, essentially.
So what's the problem here?
The problem is that if someone took out one of these loans a few years ago and they're now in a position where they need to start looking at repaying, clearly house prices have gone absolutely mad in the last year. And the amount that you pay back isn't linked to what you borrowed. It's linked to the current value of your house. So if you've bought a home that's gone up massively in value, you're potentially going to end up paying quite a bit more to the government than what you borrowed.
So if someone took out Help to Buy equity loan a few years ago, should they repay it now, start paying interest? What should you do?
I mean, it always sort of depends on the value of your home and things like that. I mean, it's and you do always benefit from the equity that you've built up as well. So those people whose houses have gone up in value, you know, they've got that extra equity. I think it's just a case of they'll probably balk a bit about paying so much back to the government. And also, so if you look at perhaps someone who took one out and paid back last year, they could have paid a few thousand pounds less than someone who took it out the same time and is paying back this year. So it's, you know, it's not the end of the world, but it's not a great feeling to end up kind of paying a few thousand pounds more into the government's pockets. You know, you've got to look at your own situation, but it's probably still better than starting to pay the interest on the loan, because every year it goes up and it can sort of spiral really quickly. So on balance, it is probably better to just kind of take the hit and pay it.
Tanya, Help to Buy fan?
I have my doubts about it. I mean, if you really, really want to get on to the housing ladder and you get lucky on the prices, then it can work for you. I mean, obviously you end up paying a bigger chunk to the government if prices go up. If you go into negative equity, you'll struggle to remortgage and be in a different kind of problem. And also, I believe, Helen, there are management fees on top of the interest after 5 years, quite stiff. It's a £12 management fee, but then it can go up into hundreds of pounds. And you're paying that on top of the interest to the government, which I think I would find that really galling. And that would make me more likely to try and get out of it within 5 years to avoid paying that kind of dead money to the government.
Of your mortgage as well, so it does after the 5 years your costs can really go up. But then again, if you remortgage, then you're probably remortgaging on a worse rate, because you've had to, you know, say if you've had the equity loan, you've had say an 80% loan to value mortgage, but you've had to go back to 90% because you've no longer got the government kind of loan there, then you're paying a higher mortgage rate. So it is, whatever happens, you end up paying a bit more after you finish with the loan. But it's, you know, if it gets you on the ladder, it gets you on the ladder, I guess.
Well, indeed. Things to think about, I guess. Things to think about. Before we move on from houses, though, I do want to talk about mortgage rates. They've been edging up over the last few months or so. on typical 2, 5, and 10-year fixed mortgages. That's despite, though, seeing some rather headline-grabbing deals coming onto the market. Nationwide this week, for example, they're launching a 2-year fix at less than 1%, but you have to have a really quite hefty deposit, 40% there. So is it better, though, overall, Helen, to take a long-term fix? Just firstly, what is happening with mortgage rates at the moment? You know, some going up, some going down.
Yeah, so on average, rates have edged up a little bit in the last few months. So according to MoneyFacts, the finance experts, since the beginning of this year, the rate on 2, 5, or 10-year fix have all sort of crept up slightly by a few percentage points. It's kind of worth saying that in historical terms, rates are still very low across the board. They're still lower than they were, say, 5 years ago, but they are a little bit higher than they were this time last year. But at the same time, we've had a couple of headline grabbing deals come out. A few weeks ago, TSB launched a 2-year fix with a 0.99% interest rate. This week, Nationwide has come out with the same deal. So very, very low. They're for people with 40% kind of equity or deposits. So they're just for quite a sort of narrow band of borrowers. And it's worth saying as well, it comes with quite a big fee. So it's £1,500 to get that 0.99% rate. But, you know, it's a very good rate. It is very low.
Why are they doing it?
So I've been talking to some brokers about this, and they say that on the lender side, it's basically a bit of a hedge against the more risky borrowing that they're doing at the other end of the market. So in recent weeks and months, a lot of lenders have brought back 5% deposit mortgages for first-time buyers and people at the other end of the market. And to do that kind of lending, they need to get more sort of secure, higher equity borrowers at the other end of the market. So to kind of balance their books. So they're putting out these good deals to try and draw in those safer borrowers so that they can feel secure lending more to first-time buyers.
Tanya, do you reckon we're going to see more like this?
It sounds that way from what Helen says. In terms of how long you should have your, you know, mortgage deal for, I know that people are always advised to go long. I have yet to find a good reason to do that. I always go for 2 years again and again, and I have a big debate with myself every time. Simon always seems to weigh in around the time that I'm doing it and makes me feel really guilty. But I think ultimately I just can't see round corners longer than two years. I mean, the pandemic is a case in point. Who saw that coming? And I just like to think that I've got the flexibility to get out and to move. And the chances are that I would be able to, you know, to remortgage with my current lender and move anyway if I absolutely had to, but I just anything can happen in 2 years, and that's far enough. Like, I can't even envisage 5 years time.
It's interesting, isn't it, Helen, because the experts in this particular article suggesting that actually it might be better to go long. When I speak to Lee about this, he's always shocked, you know, blink and 2 years you missed it. Is it, I guess, horses for courses? Know thyself. Tanya is obviously, you know, very switched on, very savvy, you know, knows her finances, knows herself, knows her, the fact that she can't see beyond 2 years, and actually that's best for her. But for someone perhaps that would prefer the security, would now be a better time to fix for longer?
Yeah, I mean, Tanya makes a good point. If you're someone who thinks they might look to move in the not too distant future, then it's possibly worth taking a shorter term so you've got that flexibility. If you don't think you're likely to move, you know, a longer term fix, 5 years can be worthwhile. I mean, it's just a peace of mind thing, I think, really, especially at the minute where things are so volatile. I mean, it's essentially making a call about where you think interest rates are going. At the minute, you know, even if they go down, they don't have much further to go. So you would be fixing at a pretty low rate. It's also worth thinking about fees. So if you remortgage every 2 years, that's obviously another set of fees to pay. So if you want that peace of mind, you want to know, you know, these are what my payments are going to be for the next 5 years, I don't have to worry about it, it can be a good thing to do. But at the minute, you know, rates are so good that either way, you're probably not going to hugely lose out.
If I may, can I ask Helen a question? Sorry, Georgie, but these fees, why are they so big? It really upsets me every time. I mean, the amount of admin work that's done is surely not great on it. It's the same for everybody. Why are we paying thousands of pounds in fees?
I think it's just one of those things. They've just crept up and up and up to this level. Yeah, that they will only ever kind of go one way. So I think it's just over time, you know, you kind of add an extra, I don't know, 50 quid. And now we've got to this level where you can be paying a grand and a half for your mortgage fees. And it is, yeah, it's essentially just another way to be able to offer rates that look really good, but still, you know, get a bit more money to the lender for them.
But I'm right in thinking, aren't I, that they aren't linked to the actual admin work involved?
No, I don't think so. I think that's no. Yeah, I mean,
thank you for confirming my suspicion.
So you pay more, they do more for you. I'm afraid I don't think that works. Is that fair, Helen?
Yeah, that's completely fair. You don't get more service for your 0.99% rate than you would for any other rate, I don't think.
Am I right in thinking that you basically add the admin fee to the rate and divide? And then compare on that basis. If they don't include the admin fee in your rate, you have to.
Yeah, exactly. So basically add it to your entire sort of mortgage amount and divide it sort of year by year or month by month. It's part of what you're paying for your mortgage. So yeah, add that into your calculations, definitely.
A good question and something really to think about as well. And we're going to leave property to one side now and homes, and we're going to be talking about our later years, because we had some research out this week, some more research actually, latest, telling us how much we need in retirement, depending on whether we want an essential one, doesn't sound great, comfortable or more luxurious time of it in our latter years. So the consumer group, which says that couples would typically need 26 grand and single people 19,000 a year to be comfortable. So comfortable is things like covering essential bills, plus, you know, regular short haul holidays, leisure activities, some alcohol in there and a bit of charitable giving. So this means a private pension pot would have to be around £154,000 between them to hit their retirement target, while an individual would need a pot just over £190,000. Tanya, we get these sorts of researches and studies fairly often. What's the use of them? Because obviously it is so individual, isn't it?
Yes, but I think they are useful in giving people an idea about what they should be heading for, and then they can work out if what they're putting away is going to hit in any way the pot that's required to turn it into an income like that. So I think it's educational as much as anything, although how much you actually need will be individual. You have to always take into account these things, who is doing it and who was surveyed. When I spoke to Which about this story, I mean they surveyed their members to get an idea, about 7,000 of them, but obviously Which members, and they admitted this, and probably more likely to be better off, they're quite savvy, they're certainly curious about their finances, even if they're not more savvy. You need to think about all of that. For me, this survey had two really interesting aspects to it. One, it really shows, you quoted those figures about the kind of pot that you'd need as a single person versus a couple. You'd need a much bigger pot than a couple to get to 19,000, when the couple, you know, with a much smaller pot can get to 26,000. The reason for that is you've got one state pension included in that instead of two, which is about, I think it's about 9,000 a year now. So obviously that's a big part of it. But also you've only got one personal tax-free allowance to play with. So you can see how quickly that would affect it as well. So I think this survey is actually most useful to single people, to tell them, you know, if you not get married, but if you're not going to get married, if you think you're not going to get married, you need to really plan to save a lot more, save a lot harder. It's going to be a lot more difficult for you to achieve a comfortable lifestyle than your married friends. And that is just the way it is. And it's better to know that now, even if you think that's pretty sort of harsh and unfair. You need to plan. And if I, you don't mind me carrying on, the other really interesting thing about this is the difference in the pot that you'd need if you were going to go into do it with drawdown versus buying an annuity. And the difference is really, really stark. The figures that you quoted at the beginning are for drawdown, and they're an awful lot higher if you want to buy an annuity and get a guaranteed income. I mean, people like a guaranteed income in retirement, but all the trends in the last few years since pension freedom show that people are prepared to invest their pension and take the risk of that, because they just feel they'll be paying through the nose for an annuity. And these figures really, really show that if you want a comfortable retirement and you don't want to absolutely spend a fortune, you've got to be prepared to invest through retirement.
Be honest though, Tanya, you're looking at these figures and thinking they're a little bit low. And the reason I say that is because, one, it only accounts for 20 years of retirement. So you're 85. Well, what if you live for longer than that? I hope you will. And also it includes a full state pension, I believe. So if you don't have that, you'd have to do 35 years of work of contributing national insurance contributions for that. Is your instinct this is just a little bit low?
I don't know about that. I think the new state pension that came in 2016 is in a transition phase at the moment, because a lot of people who are contracted out are not getting the full amount. But there's a tipping point, I think it's in 2024, where the people who were contracted out will have had enough years still in the system to knock those out or burn off those years. And they will, at that point, be qualifying for the full state pension. A lot more people will be on the full whack in terms of state pension.
Helen, I want to ask you, Paul Johnson from the IFS caused a few ripples recently by his article in another newspaper. I'm going to paraphrase this, but it's a bit more nuanced than probably I'm about to say, but it was about essentially, because we do save more in our later years, and we're sort of mean 50, then actually you shouldn't be worrying about it so much when you're younger. You've got almost more things to think about, and we should leave the kids alone, maybe. It's caused a bit of a stir. Should we be thinking about retirement only in our 50s in terms of pension savings?
I don't know. I mean, I think you've got to think about it earlier, really. For me, I'm in my early 30s and I'm still saving to buy a house. So for me, that's the hurdle that I need to get over before I really start saving seriously for retirement. But those things are inevitably going to come to a head, you know, as people start buying their first house later and later, getting on the housing ladder in retirement are kind of moving closer and closer. It's something that really you've got to be thinking about both, as tough as that is. I think really it's got to be both now.
Tanya, how far are we off as a nation? I mean, obviously that's quite a difficult question, but you know, generally from all the research, are we on course to hit these sorts of figures? We've got auto enrollment, but I understand that is probably only going to really get as an essential retirement, auto-enrollment plus the state pension. But how far are we off?
Well, I mean, it's 8% of your salary, including employers' contributions and tax relief at the moment under auto-enrollment. And industry experts are always calling for people to be trying to put away 12%. Obviously, that's not entirely you. That is bumped up a lot by your employer and tax relief. But that is a big ask for people. There's a middle generation who aren't going to get the full benefits of auto-enrollment, of being auto-enrolled for their entire working life, but they are not going to be getting much in the way of generous final salary pensions. And they are probably they're probably the worst off in this whole scenario. The people who are starting to save now, the younger people, will probably do okay, especially if they go over the 8%, especially in later life. As far as the Paul Johnson piece goes, the thing is, what you put away when you're young actually works an awful lot harder for you because of compounding, because your investment growth is on all the dividends and the performance you're getting is sort of, it adds up. So a small bit put away in your 20s gets you an awful lot more than it does when you put it away much later. And another thing I'd say about this piece is, and Paul Johnson acknowledges this himself in his piece, which is anything can happen in your 50s. You know, what if you have to give up work to care for somebody who you dearly love, who needs you? This is far more prevalent now after the pandemic and so many people with long COVID. What if you get made redundant and you really can't find another job? But then it's very difficult to save for a time. You just don't know what's happened, going to happen. So it's good that he wrote something that got people talking about it and thinking about it. But for those two reasons, I still think that young people should start saving their pension early. And I think the best way to go about it is just accept the auto-enrollment. Don't look at how much is being taken off your salary. Just put it out of your mind completely. That money is, you know, not doing anything. It's dead to you for the foreseeable future. Just don't even think about it. Don't even look at it. Don't include it in your calculations of how much you've got. Compartmentalize.
Very good advice there. And I have to say, I agree with you. I sounded a bit cynical about this research at first, but actually what I liked about it is the fact that we are talking about it. And I think that's good. And we're seeing retirement as a lifestyle rather than as a pension, you know, sort of financial term, which sounds very sensible and boring. We're actually thinking about, well, what do you want your life to look like when you're older? I think that's really important. And finally, we've got a question from a reader. I'm going to read it out because I don't want to miss anything in this. This is the reader. This is not me. I had a small personal pension valued at £20,000. I withdrew it in total earlier in the year as I needed it to pay bills during COVID-19. I paid 20% tax on £15,000, and so £5,000 was tax-free. I now realise I triggered the money purchase annual allowance, giving me only a £4,000 tax-free pension allowance a year going forward. I've now got a government job with a defined benefit pension scheme where contributions will be more than £4,000. Does the MPAA still apply as this new pension is a defined benefit pension and not a defined contribution one? Where do I stand? Tanya, where do we start? Let's start with money purchase annual allowance. What is it?
Okay, when you start tapping your pension, for which you can from the age 55, if you take more than your 25% tax-free lump sum, which this lady obviously did, you trigger something called the money purchase annual allowance, which means from then on, you're limited to putting £4,000 a year in your pension and then still get tax relief on it. So it's a pretty stiff limit. The danger is that people get so put off by the term itself or the abbreviation that they don't find out what it is. They go ahead without thinking, I might want to put more in my pension. Taking a £20,000 pot, if you're a bit short of cash, might seem like a good idea, but not in this case. Now, actually, this reader did get lucky in a way because their new job is a defined benefit or final salary pension scheme. So it doesn't kick in with that. So lucky escape in this particular case. But had this reader not been able to get that kind of job and got a job elsewhere, then they would be stuck with it. It's not reversible.
What's the advice in that situation?
Well, the thing is, when people start tapping their pensions, you have to hope that the provider will say, do you know if you did this, you'll be limited to £4,000 a year. Now, some people have been told that and they go ahead anyway. Maybe they don't quite believe it or don't quite understand the terminology and the full effect of what they're doing. We have had people write into Steve who are in that situation. But you can miss it. If you've got a financial advisor, they would definitely tell you. It's one of those things about when you make the decision at retirement, do I get financial advice or don't I? You don't know what you don't know. Simon likes to say this a lot, doesn't he? There's all sorts of things. It's perfectly possible to go through your life never hearing the words MPAA and never knowing what they are. That's fine. I mean, who would? You don't need to know it until you actually need to know it. But when you do, it can be incredibly important, as this reader discovered. And if it had been I suppose in that situation, you have to find someone with a final salary pension if you want to carry on putting lots into your pension.
Right, that's it for this week. And keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, you can, of course, follow them on Twitter, on social media, or you can email editor@thisismoney.co.uk. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.